Today on Straight Talk Africa, the challenges of the politics of succession in Africa. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are discussing political succession on the continent. The number of authoritarian leaders in Africa has declined since 2010. However, not surprising, there are still many African leaders that have been in power for more than 30 years. My colleague Paul Ndiho has more.
Western-style democracy is being tested across Africa, especially in countries where some of the world's longest-serving leaders continue to hold power. In some cases, plans to remove or circumvent presidential term limits by some leaders is alarming. By September 2019, five African heads of state had been in power for more than three decades each. Teodol Obiang Nguema Mbasogo, age 77, has been president of Equatorial Guinea for 40 years. He is arguably Africa's longest-serving president. Paul Biya, 86, has been president of Cameroon since November 1982, the second longest-serving leader on the continent with nearly 37 years in office. Yoweri Museveni, 75, the president of Uganda, has been in power for 33 years. He was re-elected to a fifth term in February 2016. Denis Sassou Nguesso, 75, has been president of the Republic of Congo for a combined total of 34 years. He first served from 1979 to 1992 and then 1997 to present. King Muswati III, age 51, is the king of Eswatini, a post he has held since April 1986. He has ruled over the kingdom for 33 years. The kingdom of Eswatini is the continent's last absolute monarch. Other leaders who have been in power for a very long time include Idriss Déby, 67 years. He has been the president of Chad for 28 years. He won a disputed fifth term in April 2016. Isaias Afwerki, age 73. The Eritrean leader has been in charge since independence in April 1993. Paul Kagame, age 61, has been the president of Rwanda since 2000. In 2017, Paul Kagame won with nearly 100% of the vote, securing a third term in office. Other previous record holders include Haile Selassie, the Ethiopian emperor, holds the African record for the longest time in power. After reigning for 44 years, he was ousted in 1974. Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi ruled for nearly 42 years. He was killed in 2011 after a protest movement turned into an armed conflict. Gabon's Omar Bongo died in June 2009 after more than 41 years in power. Angola's José Eduardo dos Santos stepped down in September 2017, having led his oil-rich country for 38 years. Eyasimbe Eyadema also ruled the West African country of Togo for 38 years, from 1967 until his death in 2005. His son, Fury Eyasimbe, succeeded him. Robert Mugabe, Zimbabwe's father of independence, was forced out in November 2017 after 37 years at the helm. He died on September 6, 2019. It's a new dawn in Sudan. Abdel Fattah al-Burhan is chairman of Sudan's newly formed Sovereign Council in Khartoum, following the ouster of the three-decade rule of former President Omar al-Bashir. Bashir tightly ruled Sudan for 30 years. In 2012, the African Union ratified the African Charter on Democracy, Elections and Governance. But critics say the continental body has failed to take similar actions against long-term serving leaders who have exploited ambiguities in the law to extend their term in office. Paul Diho, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Joining us today are two distinguished guests. Temi Ablogba, Program Associate for Africa at the Center for International Policy, and Musalia Mudavadi, a former Vice President of the Republic of Kenya and Amman National Congress Party leader. Well, I have to say, Temi and Musalia, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're most welcome, sir. Let me come to you immediately, Temi. Mm-hmm. You come from Nigeria.
Yes.
The most populous nation on the African continent. And there is a saying that for every four Africans, one may in fact be a Nigerian. Mm. And that comes with the responsibility, because there are people who say, if Nigeria can get it, the rest of Africa will follow. How do you react to that?
Yeah, of course. Because of Nigeria's size and scale, it holds a great position to be a leader, you know, in Africa, not only in the West Africa region, but for the whole continent.
Not to mention, of course, that it does have the largest economy.
Exactly.
On the continent. What about Mr. Mudavadi? You come from Kenya.
That's right.
A country that is obviously a regional power in Eastern Central Africa. What about Kenya? There are also people who say if Kenya can get it, that region will find no choice but to follow. How are you doing so far?
Well, we are doing fairly well, I would say, if we just pick it up from what we have seen. We have demonstrated that it is possible to have a fixed term of 2 years, of 5 years each, giving a maximum of 10 years in office. And we have done it. We have seen it now work for the last three presidents, and we believe that that's the way to go.
That came after the second president of the republic, your former boss.
Yes.
Daniel Toroitik, Arap Moi, had actually served for about 24 years at State House. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. In fact, the first president served for 15. And then he was succeeded, that is Jomo Kenyatta.
That is correct.
And then he was succeeded by Moi, who served initially for 10 years under the single party regime. And then our constitution was amended in 1992 to facilitate a reemergence of multi-party politics. And in that amendment, we then secured a limited term for the presidency. That is a maximum of 2 5-year terms. Mm. So Moi cunningly then argued that a constitution cannot be enacted retrospectively. So he insisted and he argued his way out that he needs to serve his first and second term if he's elected under the new constitution. Mm-hmm. And therefore he then added another 10 years and he retired in 2002.
But in fairness to Mr. Moi, he oversaw what you would call a peaceful, smooth transfer of power from himself to President Emilio Mwai Kibaki.
I agree with you, Shaka. On that score, he did not in any way attempt to prolong his stay. Once the constitution had been amended, and he had managed to serve for an additional 2 5-year terms, he may not be credited a lot, but in reality, We cannot get away without acknowledging that the fact that he decided to hand over power constitutionally, in accordance with the new constitution, was a very important legacy that he left. And we have seen his successor Kibaki do the same. And we anticipate that Kibaki's successor, who is Uhuru, and is now serving his second and final term, will also do the same.
Mr. Moi clearly has set a positive precedent.
He did set a positive precedent.
He managed his exit.
Yes, he did manage his exit. He handed over, not in a very colorful ceremony. In fact, he was being vilified.
That is true.
On that occasion.
I remember the optics.
Yes, the optics were...
They were not very pleasant.
No, but at the end of the day, when Kenyans look back in terms of hindsight, just reflecting, he did the right thing. He handed over his preferred candidate at that time,
yes,
was Uhuru Kenyatta.
You were the running mate.
I was the running mate for Uhuru. We had not won the election at that time. But he did not in any way attempt to manipulate a situation where his preferred candidate would succeed him. Once he realized that the people of Kenya had spoken through the ballot and the preferred Honorable Kibaki at that time, he accepted and went with the will of the people of Kenya.
Mwai Kibaki, a man, of course, who at one time had been his vice president for about 10 years.
That's true.
But I think that, Musalia, we also have to give credit to the gentleman who happened to be the chairman of the Independent National Electoral Commission, Samuel Kivuitu.
Yes, I think for the election of 2002, that is when Kibaki took over, Honorable Sam Kivuitu, who was the then chairman of the Electoral Commission of Kenya, did a sterling job. In fact, he stood out as an icon in terms of institutions that conduct elections at that time and facilitate good processes. Unfortunately, his Waterloo came
2007.
Came in 2007. when the few issues that happened, he cannot be solely blamed for everything, but maybe he did not read the writing on the wall at that time, because certain aspects which now showed that the electoral process was being manipulated, he presided and did not speak to those concerns. And by the time he was conducting the election of 2007, he was not totally in control. The electoral body had been hijacked by
the state,
by what you might
the
call
deep
the deep state.
State.
And therefore he could not control the situation anymore. So it's unfortunate that Kivuitu, who had distinguished himself 5 years earlier, left the electoral management process in 2007 with his head down. Which is really unfortunate.
I have to confess that he told me during our lunch at the Intercontinental Hotel a year later that he was intimidated, he was threatened. As a matter of fact, he named a gentleman by the name John Michuki, who was a very senior cabinet minister, who threatened to withdraw his security unless he signed the paper that Mr. Kibaki had won re-election.
Right. Well, we are faced with a situation where both men are no longer with us.
That's true. That's
both
true.
Michuki and Samuel Kivuitu, both of them have since passed on. So we may not be able to get much more than what we got at that time. But be that as it may, as I did say, that The tragedy in Africa is when electoral bodies that are supposed to be independent are manipulated or hijacked by forces that wish to continuously suppress the will of the people in those countries. And Kenya is not yet free from that. In fact, even the subsequent elections that Kenya has gone through, even though they have been regular and on schedule as required by the constitution,
right.
But the outcome has always been the source of a lot of controversy, sometimes heated and sometimes resulting in bloodshed. So as much as we are on the right trajectory, we are not yet out of the woods.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, tell me, what about Nigeria, the land of the ogres, pata pata? Of course, as a female, you are not entitled to that. What about Nigeria?
Yeah, so in terms of peaceful transitions from leaders to leaders,
yes.
I believe that Nigeria is a really strong example in Africa. Mm-hmm. We're currently in the Fourth Republic, which began in 1999, and since then we've seen a transition between four different leaders. So it's definitely an example, but there are a lot of struggles the country still faces within our political space. You have Boko Haram in the northeast, you have the farmers-herders conflict, you have religious persecution of Christians, you have Omoyele Sowore, who's the founder of Sahara Reporters. He was actually a presidential candidate in the 2019 elections, and he lost, but you know, a few months afterwards, he spearheaded a protest called Revolution Now, which were meant to be a peaceful, you know, protest. Mm. The idea behind these protests were that the odds are really stacked against the millions of ordinary Nigerians because of the way our political system is set up. So he wanted to, you know, peacefully protest against this. Mm. And he ended up being arrested since August 3rd. They haven't actually charged him, but they've claimed that he was trying to engage in terrorism activities and that he was trying to violently overthrow the government. So you can see how even though Nigeria has had these peaceful transitions from leader to leader, our actual civil society space and political space is still shrinking.
Do you think that you have reasonably overcome the ghosts of 1993? We're talking about June 12th, when arguably the freest, fairest, transparent, most credible election was held in your nation's history, which was apparently won by multi-billionaire Mashoud Abiora. Turned out to be, at least according to the outgoing president, General Ibrahim Badamasi Babangida, it had been won by a wrong candidate, and so he decided to annul the vote. Has the country completely moved away from that?
I think what happened on June 12, 1993, made Nigerians feel very strongly about the fact that they no longer wanted military rule. They already knew that, which is why they were trying to get Babangida out. But following him annulling the election, Abacha was able to have a coup, and he remained a military leader until, you know, he died in office.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the Nigerian people, you know, they find June 12th to be such an important day because they know that, you know, Abiola rightfully won those elections and they were the freest and fairest elections, like you said. And actually, Buhari last year, in order to honor Abiola's legacy, he changed Democracy Day from May 29th, 1999 to June 12th. So previously, it signified when, you know, military rule had switched to civilian rule. Mm. But because of pressure from the Nigerian people, he switched it to June 12th to honor Abiola's legacy. So it just showcases how much Nigerians really care about free and fair elections.
Very interesting. The other election that most people, most observers of the Nigerian political scene agree that was equally very free, verifiable, transparent, and credible was that of 2015, when the chairman of the Electoral Commission was a professor, Atahir Jega. Everybody thought that was a real election and not a selection. So what happened during the last election?
During the last election, Buhari, he won. He's currently going through his second term as the president of Nigeria. I think that because the elections were postponed, it showcased a lot of voter apathy following those elections. A lot of people didn't actually come out to vote afterwards. You know, you had people traveling from abroad to vote, people traveling from different states within Nigeria to vote, and then it was postponed. So it created a lot of discouragement. People didn't really think that their vote mattered anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, Mr. Mudavadi, I know that you have aspirations of being the president of Kenya. Which, of course, is your constitutional right. Why would you, for example, want to be president? What would be, for example, your vision? What is the vision thing for you?
Well, I think one of the things that I would really want to point out is that Kenya is facing a lot of challenges, and all countries do. But more specifically, I would like to see an economy, a country that is growing and generating jobs for the people of Kenya, especially the young people, because our demographics show that we now have 80% of our population being 35 years and below. So this is definitely something that we all must get concerned with. And therefore, we need to have a country where systems work, where the economy is able to deal with this changing demographic structure. I would like to be able to see a country where there is genuine respect for constitutionalism and the rule of law. I would like to see a country where services and like health are offered to the people and people live with dignity. And I believe that this is a challenge that our country is facing now. We are seeing a country where the public debt has now hit 60% of GDP. That means we are going to have serious problems going forward in terms of budgeting for things that really matter. Because constitutionally, when you have such a huge public debt, then as you collect your revenue as a nation, it's all going to debt repayment. So this is something that has now come to haunt us, and it needs men of serious goodwill, men and women of serious goodwill,
integrity,
and integrity,
character,
and character to come forward and start shaping the future. Because if we allow states to continue on that track, even the best of states, particularly on our continent, would quickly degenerate into a failed state. And we don't want failed states. We are having our challenges in the East African region. The good lady has just talked about Boko Haram. We have been living with the Al-Shabaab menace for a very long time. And we have seen the kind of damage they can do, because they are, any failed state around you becomes a heaven for terrorism to thrive. So Kenya needs to be taken seriously, and the leadership there needs to become more serious than we have seen. So broadly, this is the kind of thing that I look at. But Shaka, if you don't mind, let me just go back a little bit to this issue of the election. I did say that we are not yet out of the woods. There's also a new phenomenon, because election management in countries sometimes involves partnership with international entities who come in maybe to deal with the technology-related aspects. They come in maybe to handle certain data related to election. Some of them come purely for commercial reasons. Mm. And some come in, and because of the appetite for the reward they will get, they become accomplices in manipulating election results and therefore subverting democratic practices in countries, and therefore getting people to lose faith in their electoral processes. So these are challenges that, again, we need to resolve. As I said, Kenya has had its challenges, and we saw an IEBC, an independent electoral body, that is now suffering from a very serious credibility crisis.
Right.
Commissioners resigned. Mm-hmm. To date, it has not been properly constituted. Now, as much as Kenya may pride itself in having been living up to election processes religiously, mm-hmm. We must now interrogate the institutions that partner with us in this process of electioneering.
Sounds good. And one might also give credit where it is due, that at least you do have a reasonably independent judiciary system.
Yes, we do. So far, so good. Because in the history of the continent, Kenya is the one that has seen a presidential election nullified by the Supreme Court. It has never happened before. So that was indeed a major stride. But of course, I'm sure you saw that the people who did not like the decision went ahead to actually threaten the very existence of the same judiciary subsequently. And we hope that that does not happen again. Mm. But we also saw areas where the Supreme Court, as much as it nullified the election, we saw areas where the independent electoral body refused to obey the orders of the Supreme Court in certain technical aspects.
And got away with it.
And got away with it. Now, going into the future, we should not allow such kind of practices to persist.
You need to address that.
Yes.
Tell me, Mr. Musalia Mudavadi was talking about elections. Do you think when you look at your experience, you look at your research, do you think that most of Africa holds elections for the primary stakeholder, for their own people, or do they hold elections for who they call the development partners?
Yeah, I definitely think that some countries have achieved having successful democratic elections where the people's will is a priority. But I think there's a lot of countries that are still struggling. Uganda is an example of that. And, you know, the youth in Uganda have shown how disenfranchised they feel and how tired they are of what's been going on there. You have somebody like Bobi Wine, who's a presidential candidate, and he represents, you know, the new wave of Ugandans who are looking for something different in the country. But overall, I do agree with what you said, that it's not always the will of the people that's put forth. And there's a difference between being a subject and being a citizen. And a lot of that has to do with voters also educating themselves and making sure that they get civic education and they know what their rights are, and that, you know, obviously voter apathy is a result of poor leaders, but also sometimes voters not actually knowing the power that they have within their vote. So if you can have, you know, some sort of revolution in terms of learning and voters realizing what their rights are, it can help actually get people to the polls.
Very interesting. Well, time is not our best ally. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of our discussion in a moment, so please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
our voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
Are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them. Today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies. Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known. It's Upfront every Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Today we are discussing the politics of succession in Africa. Our guests are Temi Abilogba, Program Associate for Africa at the Center for International Policy, and Musalia Mudavadi, former Vice President of the Republic of Kenya and Amani National Congress Party leader. Well, Temi and Musalia, once again, I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Now, Temi, when, for example, it is time to essentially have elections, especially during the end of an incumbent president. In most of Africa, you almost can predict who is going to win. Incumbents almost never lose. They basically thrive on saying they conduct what they call periodic elections, which in fact some pundits have actually dubbed periodic selections. What do you think needs to be done in order to make sure that elections in Africa, in most of Africa, that is, because obviously there are few African countries which have met what you would call the democratic or international democratic threshold. What do you think needs to be done and must be done in order to make sure that when an election is held, the results of that election must reflect the will of the people, the will of the voters who cast the vote, and not the will of the individual who announces the results, or the will of the people who count the vote?
Yeah, so I think one of the most important things is no voter intimidation, no election rigging or interference, no last-minute changes to the election days. I think those are things that are really, really important. And then also the political space that these governments are creating in the countries leading up to the election. So the way that journalists are treated, that the media are treated, that the opposition are treated. Because one of the key parts of a strong, healthy democracy is having an opposition. If you just have one party that always has power and they no one's allowed to speak out against them, it doesn't create a space for freedom of speech. So I think those are really important parts to making sure that when elections come, they're free and they're fair.
Now, Musalia, you've been there and done it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when, for example, an individual wins an election and before he occupies the State House, he takes an oath of office. He's sworn into office. And when he or she does that, basically the words are very clear. You get into that office to defend, protect, and preserve the Constitution. And yet, most leaders on the African continent routinely violate that oath. Mm-hmm. And yet, when they violate that oath, the international community and other countries continue to do business with them as if it is normal. And yet, you see, for example, what is happening in the United States. You have heard voices of impeachment on Capitol Hill because they say that the incumbent President Donald Trump may have, in fact, violated his oath of office. You look at the United Kingdom. You look at the issue of Brexit. You have seen since David Cameron, when his party lost the election and the people voted in favor of Brexit, you are now into the third prime minister. You had Theresa May. She reached the point where she did not have essentially the support of her colleagues, her support. She basically easily stepped aside, and Parliament elected and the ruling party appointed a new prime minister. It's quite possible that in the next couple of days we might in fact even see another prime minister. And it is so orderly. People continue to go to work as if nothing in fact has happened. What can we do in most of Africa to achieve that level of confidence of doing business as usual?
Well, Shaka, you've brought up several issues in your conversation, and I'll try and isolate them. There's one that is a challenge, that is the first one I'll try and handle is the issue of presidents who take an oath of office, and then somewhere along the line, they decide to veer off from the oath that they took and engage in what you might call mutilation of their own constitutions by bringing in amendments that are clearly not consistent with the principles of their constitution in the first place. Mm-hmm. So we have that challenge. And this has come out very clearly, at least within the African continent, of presidents who have either eliminated term limits or presidents who have literally become constitutions themselves.
You have a lot of examples, at least where you come from, yes. In East Africa.
Yes. So this is a new challenge, and it's a phenomenon that we need to look at and see how it can be addressed. Now, on the other more developed countries where we have, say, the U.S., and we are seeing also the emergence of people like Johnson in the U.K., and, of course, what we see in the United States. We're also seeing a situation where in all these advanced democracies, we're also beginning to see trends of brinkmanship, trends of political leaders who are coming in and they don't seem to show the appropriate respect for their constitutional provisions. Hence what we are seeing here about threats of impeachment in a country as like this one, where you expect that institutions should work and function and the presidency should give the due respect. We are now beginning to see a regime that looks at things very differently. We are now seeing in Europe, in the UK, for instance, Boris Johnson. Being told through the Supreme Court that he overstepped his mandate in the way he handled
the prorogue of parliament. Right.
So we are seeing a dangerous trend.
But the checks and balances in that context kick in.
Now, why I want to correlate it to what is happening elsewhere is that the more they're seen to decide to ignore some provisional provisions of their constitution. What moral authority are they going to have when it comes to trying to tell other nations that they should stand by their constitutions? So this is definitely a worrying trend from the global scale, and one needs to again reflect on it. Now, Kenya has had its share of amending the constitution, and not a very good one. The first constitution we had, and then the way it was mutilated along the way. And then now we have a new constitution, which came in through a lot of turmoil and in certain instances bloodshed. And now we are seeing a clamor again of people beginning to say, no, maybe we need to amend it. Mm. But in reality, I think the real issue is that those who get an opportunity to lead have not been implementing the provisions of the constitution appropriately. Kenya's new constitution, 2010 constitution, is one of the most progressive constitutions. But there's already a clamor to see it amended. And unfortunately, it's being seen as an initiative driven by the political elite. So these are challenges that we will have to face.
But Temi, I think it has to be said that changing or amending a constitution is legitimate, because a constitution is a living document and therefore can indeed be amended, except the exception where the president or the person of the president is amending the constitution for personal and political interest.
Yeah, of course. I think what you said, calling a constitution a living document, makes sense, because the world is always changing, countries are always changing.
Correct.
Technology, the way the world works, is always changing. So it's important to make that distinction. But if a leader is changing it in the lead up to the election for their own personal gain, then that's when it really becomes an issue.
It becomes an issue. And when it becomes an issue, why doesn't it also become an issue for the international community? Because the last time I checked, it used to be that in Africa there would be military coups almost every weekend and life would go on. But the international community reached a point, and indeed the African Union itself reached a point where they said, enough is enough. If you seize power through the AK-47, without the support, democratic support of people, we are not going to continue doing business with you as usual. Now, when you have presidents, as you have on the African continent, who have actually changed the constitutions for personal and political gain, why is it that the international community cannot say, wait a minute? That, in fact, is another way of a coup. We are not going to do business with you as usual.
Yeah.
Why can't they do that?
Yeah, so I think the international community can be quite fickle about when they choose to become involved and not. I think sometimes powerful countries have their strategic interests, whether they be economic, whether they be political, that stops them, you know, from getting involved in things that are not democratic and not okay. So I think the actual interest of those countries is what stops them from getting involved.
You have a situation, for example, in Uganda, where the Ugandan president, Yoweri Museveni, back in 2001, appealed to Ugandans to vote for him so that he could, in fact, serve a second and last constitutional allowable term in order to accomplish three important things. One was to professionalize the army, as if, in fact, he would be the only individual who could do that. The second was to essentially secure what he characterized as a regional economic market. And you have to give him credit because he was one of those people who revived the East African community. And the third was to choose a successor. The last time I checked, Mr. Mudavadi, President Museveni remains at the political harem of Uganda, and today is 2019. And he apparently intends to continue running for office until probably there is the issue of what you would call the issue of divine intervention.
Well, that's...
How would you comment on that?
That's a very interesting...
Obviously, when you think about it, he probably already has accomplished the three things. He must have professionalized the army, because I have seen a lot of senior military officers coming here for advanced training. He has also been participating in international peacekeeping programs with a professional army, a respected army. He must also have secured the regional economic market, because we are talking about the East African community. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that he may also have, in fact, chosen himself as his own successor?
Well, that's a very interesting issue. But we are neighboring Uganda, so I'll make my comments reservedly. First of all, Uganda has a history of a lot of turmoil. We should never run away from that. And we have seen a lot of stability come into Uganda during the tenure of Museveni. However, that does not exonerate him from the fact that it's important that as a leading light in the region, he sets the example so that we are now able to come back to a situation where a consolidated democratic nation can now revert to good practices of democracy and be able to move forward. This is what I would bring out. But there are nine ways to skin a cat, if I may use such a terminology. Mm. And this comes into the whole issue that you bring out about regimes in Africa circumventing the constitution, or at least adhering to one aspect of it, which says that you can amend the constitution as long as you do it constitutionally.
Right.
All right? Because that is one way of upholding the same constitution. It does not prohibit amendments, but is it being done constitutionally? Now, why I bring this is that an electoral process and the rigging of an electoral process starts from very far. You can start from a population census. You can manipulate the data.
The voter register.
You can then subsequently manipulate the voter register. And then eventually you'll manipulate the election results. So when I was talking a little bit earlier in the show...
You can also appoint, of course, the Electoral Commission.
And the Electoral Commission. When I was talking a bit earlier, I was saying that these are places, these are systems that are intertwined. Mm. And we need to look at them and examine every stage so that there's integrity at every stage of it. Mm. We had players like institutions like Cambridge Analytica, who I think were also being quoted as having interfered with the elections here.
Even in Kenya
and in other places, because they're manipulating data. All this data is interlinked. And that is another area that we need to look at. Because with that data, whoever is in control of it, and most likely it will be the government in power, working in collaboration with some of these institutions, they can then justify and try and argue why a constitutional amendment is necessary and what shape it should take, because they're in control of this kind of data. Now, this, I think, bearing in mind that the OAU said that we don't want to see military coups, the AU, we don't want to see military coups. Military coups are not recognized internationally. Therefore, these leaders in Africa have now learned about the alternative ways of skinning the cat.
Precisely.
And they're skinning the cat through this process that I'm talking about, and in the process extending their tenure. But I can tell you, people can be manipulated only up to a certain point.
Correct.
Beyond that, they react differently.
Correct.
And a recent case on our continent is Sudan.
Sudan.
Where
people power
filled the void.
You also had some time back Burkina Faso.
Yes.
Where handsome Blaise Compaoré was trying to shift the political constitutional goalposts.
Yes.
In order to hang on to it, but the young people thought otherwise.
Right.
Yeah. You know, tell me, Musalia Mudavadi talked about the apparent stability in neighboring Uganda. When you hear stability, are you talking about the absence of war, the absence of mass violence, without, for example, the presence of social, political, economic justice for all?
Yeah, exactly what you just said is known as human security. So not just traditional security where you're thinking of guns and violence and all these things, but making sure that you have hospitals, that you have schools, that the things that are in place to make a human actually feel secure in terms of their economic means are set in place. So I think it's really important that African nations and also international actors that are interacting with African nations start to rethink the way they see security and no longer see it as an over-militarization, but see it as something that is, you know, it's a spectrum. It's so many different things that need to be looked at.
What is power if it cannot be used as a force for good?
Exactly.
What is power?
You're asking me what I personally think power is.
I thought really the basic reason why you need power is to use it as a force for good.
For good, yeah.
For example, improving the quality of life of your people.
Yeah. And having those people also respect you, I think that's a huge part of power. And a lot of these leaders who are, you know, staying there for ages and ages, you have Paul Biya in Cameroon. He's been there for 37 years, and now look at the state of his country, really.
You're adding no value.
Exactly. They're wanting to separate. How can you be there for so long and have that be the state of your country? There's obviously an issue.
You're adding no value. You have no legitimacy. You're not improving the quality of your people. He is the sort of person sometimes that takes extended vacations in Switzerland.
Exactly.
At the Intercontinental. For months.
Yeah.
On the backs of the ordinary taxpayer of Cameroon.
Exactly.
What kind of power is that?
It's a power that's very backwards. I think in African nations, people tend to see public service as a way of making it, of becoming a millionaire, becoming a billionaire. They don't actually see it as an act of service, of coming to help their people. So I think also a reframing of the way that we actually see public service on the continent is also very, very important.
You know, there is a saying that if wealth is gone, nothing is gone. If health is gone, something is gone. But if character and integrity are gone, everything is gone. What do you read into that?
Yeah, I think that's an amazing quote. Who said it? Do you know? Or is it just something that people say normally?
How do you react to that, Mr. Mudavadi?
Well, I think it's a very deep comment. Apparently, I happened to have visited Cameroon some time back. I was a guest representing the government of Kenya, or the nation of Kenya, at their independence celebrations. Mm-hmm. And I had an opportunity to traverse some parts of this country.
You were in Yaoundé?
In Yaoundé, but mm-hmm. We drove several kilometers in different parts.
A beautiful country.
Yes. In terms of the greenery and the environment I saw. But in terms of infrastructure development, I wondered whether it was truly an oil-producing nation, a nation that is so rich in terms of even timber and so forth.
And a country that, to use your words, that is stable.
Yes. So, but one of the things that amazed me was that I know people celebrate their national holidays differently. You know, they can have a march past of some sections of their military or disciplined forces. They sometimes can have various dancers passing by in a carnival mood. But I can tell you, I saw the longest parade that I've ever seen anywhere in Cameroon.
Interesting.
It went on for almost 2 hours.
Let me ask you the last question. Time is not our best ally.
Yes.
And please attempt to answer it.
Yes.
What would you say is the single most important decision that you have ever made during your public service, mm-hmm. and the single most regrettable decision during the same period?
The most positive...
30 seconds.
Killing one corruption problem in Kenya called Golden Bag.
Thank you.
Stabilizing the financial system.
Well, on that note, our guests today were Temi Ablogba and Musalia Mudavadi. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.